Well, greetings everyone, and welcome to the Law Hour and Editorial Review. The Law Hour is sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. Now, the Law Hour is an educational service brought to you in the public interest. I'm your narrator, George Gordon. The Law Hour and Editorial Review is heard nationally and internationally 7 days a week here in the United States, and we're heard around the world in more than 120 countries daily over the Internet. For more information about the Law Hour and Editorial Review, please visit our webpage at georgegordon.org. Again, that's georgegordon.org. Now, the Law Hour and Editorial Review brings you important information about law, science, education, politics, religion, health, history, economics, news, and current events. So stay tuned for tonight's special report on freedom of speech when we come back. You know, 3,000 years ago, before the science of meteorology was even thought of, Solomon wrote in Ecclesiastes 1, verse 7, that all of the rivers run into the sea, and yet the sea isn't full. And unto the place from whence the rivers come, thither they return again. Well, every year the continents and islands of this earth pour down into the oceans a stupendous volume of water. In fact, it's about 286,000 cubic miles of water flow into the oceans every year. And for century after century, millennium after millennium, this has been going on. And the sea hasn't been increased by so much as an inch. Now, how is that possible? Well, we call it the cycle of evaporation and precipitation. And the writer of Ecclesiastes said that the ocean maintains its level in spite of this gigantic annual influx, because the rivers go back to the place from whence they came. And indeed they do. Every drop of rain that falls climbs back upon the Creator's elevator of evaporation to form themselves into clouds and then ride back to the head of their toboggan slide and begin their journey all over again. Well, in the modern science of meteorology, all of this is understood and its laws are totally and perfectly comprehended. But modern science today has simply learned what the writer of Ecclesiastes knew 3,000 years ago. And that's just one more of the many examples of science in Scripture. And it's one more of the many lessons that we teach here in our Mosaic Law School. And we conduct that school here twice a year in Isabella, Missouri. Now, if you'd like more information, why don't you call and order our free General Law CD package. It's a four-hour commentary on the law in general. And it's educational, it's informative, it's entertaining. Best of all, it's free. The number to call is 417-273-4967. Once more, that's area code 417-273-4967. And if you're online, you can go to our website, georgegordon.org, georgegordon.org. Just click on the email machine and send us an email request for that free General Law CD package. Now, once more, that's georgegordon.org, or call us direct at 417-273-4967. All right, we're talking about freedom of speech. And Larry B. Craft wrote an article in his section, or on his treatise, called Destroyed Arguments, that I refer to quite often and cite from quite often and agree with, at least in most aspects. But occasionally, one of my students will say to me, in fact, occasionally, hell, it's quite often, they'll say, why do you tout this guy's treatise when he runs you down? Contradiction, makes fun of you, and so on. I have never taken somebody's position against me and taken it personally and said, well, I think that this guy over here is just doing this because he doesn't like me, or for whatever reason he's running me down. Freedom of speech has to do with people's honest disagreement based upon the input, or based upon what they believe, what based upon the input from their five senses into their computers, their brains, and that they're probably acting in good faith. At least that's the way we begin the discussion. In some cases, it's probably done with malice and premeditated forethought, and they probably have bad intent involved and so on, but not as a general rule, at least that's not my experience. And when a subject matter comes up and we have an opinion concerning that, sometimes we get into dialogue, debate, sometimes called, And what we really should be looking at, or what we should be really trying to accomplish here, is how can we all come to a consensus and a better understanding of what we're dealing with? And that's why I brought up the subject of the manufacturer certificate of origin. Because Beecraft, in his treatise, said that this manufacturer's certificate of origin, the MCO argument, is another crazy idea promoted by people who refuse to perform any research. Hang on here. I've just put 2 hours of material right in front of your eyeballs concerning superior title and ownership, property rights. I went back into the history, albeit, you know, I don't deny now that it's a cursory overview of McKinsey and of driver's licenses and registration. But hey, listen, I've done a lot of research here, and I've got a lot of information. That doesn't mean that all of my information is true, accurate, or correct. But I presume that it is, at least when I walk into the discussion. I'm presuming that I've done my homework, did my research, and that my report on Robert Fox, my report on our 5 students in California, Louis Meintzer, his experience in Albuquerque, New Mexico, my personal experience with the Supreme Court of Idaho, you know, I presented it in good faith. I said, well, this has been our experience. Here's our outcome. Here's our experience with the manufacturer's certificate of origin. Have you done the same thing? Now, I don't know what Beecraft's experience is with the MCO. I don't know if he's ever done a case with an MCO. Maybe, maybe not. Maybe his outcome was different. Well, if it is, well, why was it different? What created or caused that? That does happen in law. You can go into court on one case, and the jury comes back and exonerates the guy. They just find him not guilty, and out the door he goes. Next guy comes in, the jury finds him guilty and sends him off to jail, and the judge imposes the sentence. What's the difference? Well, the first guy may have been guilty, and he was exonerated by mistake by the jury. The second guy, maybe it was exactly the opposite. He was innocent, but the jury convicted him. That's why we have an appellate process. Juries make mistakes. So do judges. That's why sometimes judges are overruled, and the appellate court comes back, and appellate courts are made up of more than one judge. Usually 3, sometimes 15. You know, you can have an in-bank hearing in front of the full Ninth Circuit with 15 judges sitting there voting 8-7. Well, does that mean the 7 judges that are in the losing side, does that mean they're stupid? Does it mean that when the Supreme Court of the United States divides 5-4, that 4 judges are stupid because the 5 judges are the majority, therefore the majority is right? Hell no. Majorities are oftentimes wrong. We hope, based upon the biblical admonition that there is safety in a multitude of counsel, that by the time a judge hears this, the judge is a fellow who works 8 hours a day, probably longer than 8 hours a day if you knew the truth of the matter. But at least he works 8 hours a day, 5 days a week, probably more than 5 days a week, if you knew the truth of the matter. And he's a paid professional. He's an experienced jurist. He understands law and the ins and outs of it better than all the rest of us. And when he comes back and he makes a decision, it's probably right. And I don't deny that. Most of the time they are. Most of the time when the judge comes back with a decision, the guy's right. But not always. And so we take it up on appeal. And then we go to the Court of Appeals, and there's 3 judges there. And sometimes you'll get a decision out of the appellate court, and the 3 judges in the appeals court say, hey, here's the way we see this. They might rule on this case 3-0. Or maybe it's 2-1. But the majority of the judges on the Court of Appeals, they say, hey, here's our decision. Here's the way we see this. Does that mean that the judge that dissented, that one lone voice, that voice crying in the wilderness, is stupid? The guy's out to lunch. He's crazy? I dissent from that opinion. I don't believe it for a minute. Now, after you've been to your Court of Appeals and you're dissatisfied with the decision, you can appeal to your state Supreme Court. Now, most states have 7 members. They have at least 5, and most of them have 7 members of the Supreme Court. Now, one judge made a decision, then 3 judges made a decision. You're still not happy. So now let's take it up to 7 judges. Okay. Now, here comes a multitude of counsel now. These 7 judges listen to this argument, and they come to a conclusion. Maybe they divide 4-3. Maybe they decide the case 7-0 against you. That's what happened with Rosa Parks. For crying out loud, let's wake up and smell some coffee here. That woman never won a single hearing. She never won the trial. She didn't win jack squat until she got to the U.S. Supreme Court. She only won one time, which just happened to be the one time that counted. But, you know, the 7 judges of your state Supreme Court could be wrong. And sometimes they are, not very often. Now, I'm not here to tell you, you know, that the Supreme Court's full of prunes and they're wrong. Once in a while they are, not too often. And then we finally go to the Court of Last Resorts. It's the United States Supreme Court. Now we got 9 members up there, and these 9 guys, sometimes cases are decided 5-4. Does that mean that the 4 judges that dissented in their opinion are stupid or crazy? I don't believe that for a minute. But they have a reason. That's what free speech is all about. And oftentimes these guys will write an opinion. It's called the dissenting opinion. Say, okay, I don't agree with the majority. I think that this decision today is a mistake. And here's why I think that's a mistake. And so when people disagree with me, I don't say that they're crazy or that they haven't done their research or they don't know what they're talking about. In some cases, that may be true. But I'm not going to just blanket, you know, come out and say, well, that guy's stupid. Now, this MCO argument is another crazy idea promoted by people who refuse to perform any research. I dissent from that opinion. I've done a lot of research. I may be dead ass wrong, but I don't believe it. I don't believe it for a minute. If I thought I was wrong, I'd have changed my opinion. Now, a guy called me one time. His name is Erwin Schiff. Hell of a nice guy. I like him. I first met him in Marin, California. He was on the lecture circuit. I was on the lecture circuit. At the time, Erwin Schiff, he's older than I think he's pushing 80. I'm 70. I think he's pushing 80. So he's 10 or 15 years older than I am, and there's an old biblical proverb that says, you know, you should rise up before the hoary head. So when some old fart comes in, he's got gray hair, you know, look at him, pay attention. He's been around longer than you have, likely, and he probably knows more than you do. So I approach people with white hair a little differently than the average. I look at him and say, that guy probably knows something. And so Schiff made a presentation. And when he got through with his presentation, I didn't agree with everything that the man said. He said the income tax was unconstitutional. I didn't think so at the time, and I still don't think so. I think the income tax is bad, wicked, terrible, awful, evil. I think it's a crime. I think that it runs counter to the Ten Commandments, that it runs counter to our Constitution and our Bill of Rights. I haven't got one good word about the income tax, but I've never said that it was unconstitutional. In fact, early on, I made a study of the income tax, and I found 38 cases where the U.S. Supreme Court said that it was, in fact, constitutional. So in spite of the fact that it's bad, wicked, terrible, awful, and evil, it's not unconstitutional. You know, let's face reality here. Let's wake up and smell the coffee. And Irwin Schiff said, oh, I think the income tax is bad, wicked, terrible, awful, and evil. And I said, right on, Irwin. Give him hell. Well, okay, but his take on it is a little different than mine. And so some time went by, and one day Irwin Schiff was prosecuted for tax evasion. And when that first came up, I said to my wife, I said, call Irwin, get him on the phone. I'd like to talk to him. And she did, and at that time he was living up in Connecticut, see? And got him on the phone and said, hey, Irwin, how's things going? We chewed the rag there for a little while, and I said, hey, I'm reading the paper here, and I see you've been indicted for tax evasion. And I said, now, I operate a school down here. At the time, I was here in Isabel, Missouri. I'd moved from Boise, Idaho, and I said, I'm down here in Isabel. And I said, you know, I've learned some things, and there's some things that I know, and I'd like to share that with you. And if you'll come down here to school, I'll put you through school free. I won't charge you any tuition. I'm not trying to get any money out of you. I want to help you. And he said, George, I'd love to. And he said, but I can't because, see, I'm working on this case. I'm just up to my asshole in alligators, he said. And I just haven't got the time. But if I had the time, I would, but I haven't got the time. So I said, well, I hear you, but remember the offer's open. And I respect you, and I'm sure that you know more than I do, and I'm sure you know what you're doing, and God love you, and I wish you the best, and I hope you beat the socks off of them. Well, some time went by, and my wife came in and said, Irwin Schiff was convicted. And I lamented, and I said, well, I'm sorry to hear that, and I wish that hadn't happened. So some time went by, and he was sentenced, and he went to jail. Okay, so some years went by, and one day my wife, she said, Irwin Schiff's been released from jail. And I said, well, hallelujah, praise the Lord. Irwin's out of jail, and I'm happy for him. And some time went by, and one day my wife came in. She says, hey, I'm reading the paper here, and I see Irwin Schiff's been indicted for tax evasion again, or willful failure to file, or some kind of tax charge. And I said, oh, my God. I said, get him on the phone. And she did, and I said, Irwin, I hear you've been indicted again. And he said, yep, I have. And he told me about his defense strategy and told me about what he thought and about what dirty, no-good, low-down louts they were. And I agreed with him. And I said, now, Irwin, I'd like you to come down to school here, and I won't charge you anything. And I was having class here the other day, and I said, now, I haven't done that for any of you people. I make you people pay. I charge you people when you come here to school. You have to pay your tuition. But not Irwin. I didn't tell him that. I said, you come down here, I'll do this for you free. And that's because there are some things that I think I know that maybe you don't know. Maybe you've never heard this before. Maybe I know something that could help you. And I want to give it to you, free of charge. And he said, George, I'm up to my asshole in alligators. And I just haven't got the time, but if I had the time, I would. And I'm sorry as hell, but, you know, that's the way life is. And I said, okay. Well, listen, remember the offer's open. And if I can help you in any way, I want to. And it isn't going to cost you anything, and blah, blah, blah. Well, some time went by, and one day my wife said, hey, I'm reading the paper. And I see Irwin Schiff has been convicted again. So I lamented, and I was sad. And I didn't fast. I didn't shave off my hair, you know, and do anything crazy and wild or religious, but I was saddened by the fact that Irwin Schiff had been convicted again. And he was going to jail. And so one day, my wife told me, well, Irwin Schiff has been released from jail. And so I was happy, and I said, well, hallelujah and praise the Lord. And I'm real tickled about that. And so some more time went by, some years went by, and one day my wife said to me, Irwin Schiff has been indicted again. This is the third time. And she said, do you want me to get him on the phone? And I said, no. And she said to me, why not? When he was indicted the first time, you said, get him on the phone. When he was indicted the second time, you said, get him on the phone. Now he's indicted the third time. Why don't you want me to get him on the phone? I said, I don't need to. And my wife said, why? And I said, because he's up to his asshole in alligators, busy working on his defense. And she said, but he's probably going to be convicted. I said, more than likely. Well, isn't that going to make you feel bad? Terrible. Well, then why don't you want to help him? Because he didn't call me. He didn't ask. You know, that's what free speech is all about, too. You know, you got to ask. You know, I'd like to help you, but, you know, if you don't ask, you know, don't know if I can help you. And I'm not an evangelist. I'm not out here trying to overthrow the IRS or the EPA or the State Tax Commission or anybody else. The government needs taxes to run, for crying out loud. I'm not sitting here arguing with them. Even if it's a criminal enterprise or operation. Listen, the Federal Reserve is a crime. The Federal Reserve is a criminal act. It's a violation of the law of God. They deal in unjust weights and balances. They deal in interest and usury. These are crimes. You know, we don't deal with the mafia because they're criminals. That's why I don't deal with the Federal Reserve. They're criminals. But I'm not trying to overthrow the mafia. So, you know, if you're working for the mafia, don't think that it's incumbent now that you need to snuff me out because I don't do business with you, because I don't like you. I don't like your criminal behavior, mafia, any more than I like the criminal behavior of the Federal Reserve or Tim Gaither or Henry Paulson or the New York bankers or anybody else. Those are criminal enterprises. That's why I don't have a bank account. I don't have a credit card. I don't do business with criminal enterprises. It's bad for me. It's bad for them, too, if they only understood it. But well, Erwin Schiff was convicted, and he went to jail again. The last time I heard, he's got four. He's been convicted four times. I don't sit back and say with relish, ha-ha, well, he should have listened to me. It was a crazy idea. I'm not sure that Erwin Schiff is crazy, and I'm not sure that all of his ideas are wrong. Some of his ideas are not correct. And he needed a little more information put into his computer. For instance, his belief that the income tax is unconstitutional, I think, is an error. And the Supreme Court thought it was an error. The trial judge thought it was an error, and so did the jury. Not once, not twice, not three times, but four. Now, that being the case, is there some other way? Is there something else that needs to be put into the equation? That's my point. Now, oftentimes students come here to school and they have crazy ideas, to my mind. I mean, they're really off the wall. But, hey, wait a minute. They're not totally crazy. There is a basis in their beliefs, otherwise they wouldn't have those beliefs. And their right to express those beliefs, I think, is very important. And it's important for them. Hell, it's even important for me. Because maybe they know something that I don't know. Maybe Larry Beecraft knows something here that I don't know. Maybe I can learn something from him, and I can add that to my total fund of knowledge, and then I can get smarter and smarter. And that's the bottom line to this Erwin Schiff story. I said to Erwin, if you come down here, when you leave, you're going to be smarter than I am. And he laughed, and he said, well, what makes you think that, George? And I said, well, listen, I'm going to tell you what I know. And you're going to add that to what you already know, which is more than I know, which is going to make you smarter than me, because you're not going to tell me what you know. So I'm going to know what I know, but I'm not going to know what you know, but you're going to know what I know plus what you know, and that's going to make you smarter than me, and that'll give you a better edge on defeating the IRS and the prosecution. He agreed with me, but he didn't come to school. So he didn't find out what I knew. And I didn't tell him. And I didn't tell him because he didn't want to know. Because if he wanted to know, he would ask. And I don't think it's my duty to run around trying to force what I believe and force what I believe on other people. That's why I'm not going around knocking on people's door and asking them if they know Jesus. I figure they either already know Jesus or they didn't want to meet him. One or the other. I didn't need to go out here and knock on their door, make a pest of myself. All right, same thing's true with law, same thing's true with anything that we're dealing with. Now, last time, remember I told you, I said there's a little something more to this MSO than meets the eyelash, meets the eyebrow. There's something to it, but maybe we don't have all the information that goes into it. And it's called an adhesion contract. I've covered that more than once, talking about adhesion contracts. Last time I said, let me bring you up to speed with a case called Thompson v. Smith. It's W.L. Thompson versus D.C. Smith, state Supreme Court case out of Virginia, 1930. And the court had more to say. I told you last time some of what they had to say, but they had a little bit more. They said, this doctrine has been pronounced most often in cases. Now, what doctrine are we talking about here? All right, now listen to this. I'm going to give you the doctrine again. I gave it to you in the last program. Just take a minute. Now listen to this. The right of a citizen to travel. Travel. Got that word travel in your mind? Travel. I want to travel from California to New York. How do we want to travel? Do we want to travel by airplane? Do we want to walk? Do we want to ride a bicycle? Ride a horse? Drive an automobile? Drive a horse and carriage? Travel. The right of a citizen to travel upon a public highway and to transport his property thereon. Notice the word property. Property. Thereon, in the ordinary course of life and business, is a common right. It's a common law right, which he has under his right to enjoy life, liberty, and to acquire and possess property. That's life, liberty, and property, the fundamentals of our federal constitution. Boys and girls, your right to do that on a public highway is fundamental. Now, going on, they said, it includes the right in so doing to use the ordinary and usual conveyances of the day, and under the existing modes of travel includes the right to drive a horse-drawn carriage or wagon thereon, or to operate an automobile thereon for the usual and ordinary purposes of life and business. Hell, 1930, they still recognized your automobile as a property right. Equal to a horse and buggy or a wagon thereon. Tain't today. But it was then, in 1930, you know, it wasn't forever ago. It's a little older than I am, but it wasn't back in the Middle Ages. We're not talking about, you know, going back to ancient times with Hammurabi's Code now. Talking about the Supreme Court of Virginia. And by the way, I can pull cases like this out from nearly every state in the Union. So when Larry Beecraft says, you know, hey, dummy, hey, you crazy. This is one of them crazy arguments. Hey, wait a minute, Larry. Let me make an observation. I'm not sure that it's a crazy idea just because you don't agree with it. And so I wanted to point that out, that maybe in your mind it's a crazy idea. You know, this MCO argument is another crazy idea promoted by people who refuse to perform any research. And then he went on to say, this is Larry Beecraft, says, when a car manufacturer builds a car, that company owns it and has title to it. No, they don't. They don't own it, and they don't have title to it. They have a possessory. They have a bundle of rights attached to it, but they don't own it. As is evidenced by the fact that the federal government comes in and mandates to them how many miles per gallon that the car has to get before they can sell it, or how many emissions can come out of the tailpipe or they can't sell it. There's a superior title there, Mr. Beecraft. and the federal government possesses the superior title. I'm not sitting here arguing that the automobile company doesn't have some property rights in it, but by gosh, it ain't absolute, and it ain't a property right. It isn't the sole and despotic use of the property. You don't see Ford saying to the governor of California, to hell with you, and we're going to sell our car in your state whether you like it or not. All right, now with that in mind, then, the title to personal property like a car is not some document. It is that invisible bundle of rights which one has when he owns something. That bundle of rights includes all other parties, or excludes, rather, all other parties from possession of the property in question. No, it doesn't. No, it doesn't. Larry, you know that. Come on. You know as well as I do that when the highway patrolman stops you, he can seize that automobile and call a tow truck and have him hauled away. And you go ahead and sue the towing company. I've done that time and again. Find out what happened. The towing company has qualified immunity, and so does the highway patrolman. The state owns the automobile. In fact, the Supreme Court of Idaho told me in no uncertain terms, if Gordon could prove he owned the automobile, hell, Larry, I had the title. I had the certificate. I had the registration. I had the bill of sale. And then all of a sudden, the state Supreme Court says, well, if Gordon could prove he owned the automobile, we'd have a much different case before us, which is exactly the same words that the New York Supreme Court used. If this guy owned the automobile, yeah, we could talk to him. All right, so obviously you don't own it. Well, then somebody must own it, because somebody here is exercising superior rights to mine. That's the way that game goes. But it wasn't always that way in this country. In fact, as recently as 1930, here's your state Supreme Court in Virginia. Now, I've got to give you a reminder here. We're at the middle of the program. But now with that little piece of understanding in mind here, I'm going to share with you a little bit more than maybe you knew before. Let's take a look at this doctrine, which has been pronounced most often in cases involving the granting, refusing, and revoking of licenses or permits to sell intoxicating liquors or to do other things which, because of their character, are or tend to be injurious. Where does the state get in here with the police powers to regulate? And where does my property right begin and end? Right after this. Hang on. You're listening to the Law Hour, an editorial review sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. Now, the Law Hour is heard 7 days a week here in the United States, and we're heard around the world in more than 120 countries daily over the Internet and radio. Now, if you'd like more information about the Law School and the Law Hour, then please go to our website at georgegordon.org. That's georgegordon.org. Remember, the law school teaches family law, tax law, courtroom strategy and procedure, business law, agricultural law, civil rights, and biblical law from the scriptural perspective. Now, that's 8 schools in all. The law school is a private, non-commercial, non-profit, non-sectarian law school. It is open to individuals, but by prearrangement. Now, the law school conducts a homeschooling program for adults on compact desk, and the Law Hour website is updated weekly. It has our radio log schedule and archives. All of that can be accessed through our website at georgegordon.org. And all of these Law Hour programs are archived on the Internet by title and date for your listening convenience, and the Law Hour is an educational service brought to you in the public interest. Now, the Law Hour and the Law School offers a free 4-hour introductory CD package. Be sure to order yours by calling the Law School and asking for it. The number's 417-273-4967. Once again, that's area code 417-273-4967. Now, the sources of information that we use on this program are true, accurate, and correct to the best of our knowledge and belief. And the Law Hour and editorial review gives credit to those authors and publications that we use on this program. And we often endorse or recommend books, papers, periodicals, and newsletters to our listeners. Now, these endorsements, these recommendations that we give, don't mean that the authors or publications that we're endorsing and recommending are necessarily going to reciprocate. We should keep in mind that most of these authors and publications that we cite here on the Law Hour and Editorial Review may be hostile. Sometimes they're political, they can be religious, they may be economic or sectarian, they may be racial, they may be ethnic partisans. And their viewpoint may not be totally endorsed by the Law Hour and Editorial Review. These opinions, beliefs, comments, views, and expressions that you hear on this program are mine. They're mine alone. They don't necessarily represent the views, beliefs, or the opinions of the advertisers, sponsors, the management, or the staff of this radio network or of this local radio station. Now, if you'd like more information about the Law Hour and Editorial Review, then please go to our website. Remember, that's georgegordon.org, georgegordon.org. Or you can reach us by phone. Just call us, 417-273-4967. All right, we are talking about freedom of speech, and we are reviewing, we're talking about the manufacturer's certificate of origin. And I wanted to point out here, in a case called W.L. Thompson versus D.C. Smith, you might want to write this down. It's at 154 Southeast 579. That's the reporter. Comes out of Virginia. Virginia Supreme Court of Appeals. September 12th, 1930. Cited at 154 Southeast 579. Called W.L. Thompson versus D.C. Smith, Chief of Police of the City of Lynchburg, Virginia. Got a little story to tell you over here about this thing. Well, they're not talking about the MCO directly. This is before MCOs. This is when people still had rights. And then something happened to our right to travel, at least our right to travel by automobile. See? Now, we go to public school and they say, driving is a privilege. Okay, I don't deny it. Driving is a privilege. But travel is a right. And the means or the modality that I decide to travel is also a right. Now, that right's been suspended, terminated, taken away. What we're trying to do is figure out why, and we're trying to use free speech to do that. So now, this doctrine has been pronounced most often in cases involving the granting, refusing, and revoking of licenses or permits to sell intoxicating liquors. This is commerce now, remember? This is where Almeida Sanchez comes in. We covered that, remember? Guy's hauling marijuana in his car. He's not in a regulated business, but if you are in a regulated business, you come under the police powers. Or, for instance, keeping a gambling house or a bawdy house, or operating a junk or a pawn shop. And it has also been applied to cases involving permits or licenses to transport persons or property for hire along the streets. See Taylor versus Smith, and cases there cited. But this doctrine has no application to permits issued for the purpose of regulating the exercise of the common right to operate a private automobile on the streets of a city in the usual and ordinary way to transport the driver's person and property. Now, this is pretty important, kids. Listen, gather around. Listen up here. If you're going to operate a taxi cab or a trucking company, if you're going to haul somebody else's property for hire up and down the highways, you can be required by the state to get a license, to get a registration, to get a permit. Comes under the police powers and deals with regulation. I'm not arguing that. But what I am arguing is a personal property right in an automobile and my right to use the automobile as property. And what happened? Well, what happened was back in 1933 when President Roosevelt, with House Joint Resolution 192, suspended gold payments. And then, of course, we all went along with it. And as a result of that, we were unable to pay our debts at law. So when we went down to buy an automobile, we couldn't pay for it. So we couldn't own the car. So the state moves in and says, okay, here's our move. We're going to regulate and control these automobiles under the police powers by regulation. Can they do that? Absolutely. Absolutely. That's the way they did it. That's the trick. So I just wanted to pass that on. You know, there's a little bit more to the story than the average guy has. In 1930, we had a right to the automobile, but something happened. What was it? House Joint Resolution 192 happened, which has later been codified. Now, there's been some more changes in the law. In 1986, Congress enacted what they called the Tax Reform Act of 1986 and codified it. It's codified now at Title 31, Section 5102 through 5112, I believe it is, 13, 14, something like that. We got our gold and silver coin back. Unfortunately, in the years between 1933 and 1986, we Americans have forgotten how to use hard money. We don't know what the hell to do with it. I know, I oftentimes offer hard money to businessmen, and they look at you with a blank stare, like, how am I going to pay my bills with gold coin? The same way we paid our bills with gold coin in 1920, 1930, 1840, 1620, 300 BC, 3000 BC. What the hell's wrong with gold coin? It's the way we pay our debts at law in Anglo-Saxon administration. It's the way we establish our property rights. It's the way we reestablish our property rights once we have abandoned those rights. That's the story. And that's the story that isn't being told here by Larry and the MCO. This MCO argument's another crazy idea promoted by people who refuse to perform any research. You got a point there, Larry. I don't disagree with your point. This lady who wrote you the letter and said the deceitful lawyers, DBA, the state, coerced these dealers into stealing the real bill of sale. That's diatribe, and that's political diatribe. I hear you. I agree. But that lady isn't totally off point here. She might not have all of the story. She might not have all of the facts. And maybe she has drawn conclusions based upon insufficient evidence. And I don't deny it. But she's not crazy. And it may not be that she has not done any research. Maybe she needed to do a little more research. Maybe there was, you know, a little bit more to the story that she needed to know. So when people come up with free speech and they make a statement or they make an argument, I'll tell you what really boggles my mind with these crazy arguments, as Larry Beecraft puts it. I'm teaching school this week. And one of the students here this week is talking to other students in the class about the straw man, you know, and about all these terms and conditions that go along with it, if you'll remember from last week. Now, the students that are here this week, see, they're going to say when they go home, well, I learned this at the Gordon Law School. And they're going to mix in what they've learned here this week from my material and what they learned from other students this week and confuse the two. And then they're going to come up with what we teach here at the law school combined with the straw man and some of these other UCC 1-207 and all the rest of this crap that goes along with it that I call crap, that Larry Beecraft called crap. And then they're going to allege that I'm the guy that taught that to them, and that's not true. And it boggles my mind every time I come across that. People say, oh, I learned it there at your school, Mr. Gordon. No, you didn't. That is not what we teach here. I oftentimes are labeled, there's an outfit called the Southern Poverty Law Center. And they put out derogatory material about me every once in a while. They call me a tax protester and an extremist. I am not a tax protester and I'm not an extremist. They called me a cult. I'm not a cult leader. This isn't a cult. Go look up the word cult for crying out loud and then apply the definition to George Gordon and the Gordon Law School. It doesn't fit. That's what I object to. I don't mind people calling me what I am, a dirty, low-down, no-good, lying, deceiving, you know, good-for-nothing, you know, at least brand me what I really am. Don't lie about me. You know, I've often told my students, I said, the worst thing that can happen to you in court is that your enemies tell the truth about you. That's the worst thing that can happen. When they lie about you, it doesn't hurt you. You can come in here and prove that they're lying. What you can't refute is when they tell the truth about you. So, why don't you people stick with the truth, would you? If you want to run me down, go ahead. But at least stick with the facts. Now, let's get all the facts on the table. Free speech enables everybody to exercise their opinions. The Southern Poverty Law Center has a right to their opinion about George Gordon, but they don't have a right to lie about me. They don't have a right to slander and libel and lie. So I like to be careful about branding people with names. I don't like to use the word, well, this is a crazy argument by crazy people that don't do their research. Hell, I don't know if this lady researched this or not. I don't know how much research Larry B. Craft did or didn't do. And he's certainly entitled to his opinion. And he doesn't have to agree with me. And I'm not mad at him because he doesn't. You know, just lay the facts out as best you know. And then let's go from there. Now, let me pass on one more little piece of information. This comes from a case called Charles Wolf Packing Company versus the Court of Industrial Relations of the State of Kansas. Back in 1923, an issue came up concerning private business. And I teach a class here on private business. Public business are those things that are done publicly. When you open a checking account at your local bank, that is public business. When you buy stocks in General Motors, that's public business. Now, when you pay a debt with gold coin, that's private business. And when you buy a piece of property and pay for it with gold coin and take a quitclaim deed and don't record it, that's private business. When you take a warranty deed and you record it, that's public business. You know, there's business that's out here in the public domain, and then there's private business that's none of your business, and I ain't telling. One time a guy asked me, he says, well, why is it that you're so paranoid? He used the word paranoid, kind of with an expletive, like, why is it that you're so paranoid? It isn't, why are you paranoid, Mr. Gordon? It's, why are you so paranoid about government knowing about your business, talking about the income tax return? And I said, because it involves my privacy. And he said, well, what is it about your privacy that you're so paranoid about? And I said, well, if I told you what it was about my privacy that I'm paranoid about, it wouldn't be private anymore. The reason I don't want to tell you about what it is that I don't want to tell you is because if I told you, then it wouldn't be private. Can you understand that? Normal people can't, because normal people don't have any privacy. And because they don't have any privacy, you come along and you say, I don't want to tell you. And they look at you like, well, what do you got to hide? My God, you must be hiding something. You must be a criminal, a terrorist. Because you're not divulging everything to me. Well, hang on here a second, boys and girls. You know our Constitution and the Fourth Amendment and our Bill of Rights protects a man and his person, houses, papers, and effects. That's good rhetoric. My God, don't you try to put that into practice now. Because if you do, you'll be on somebody's list at the Department of Homeland Security or the Southern Poverty Law Center or somebody. They're going to say, oh my God, that guy's paranoid. He's got something to hide. And that's what free speech is all about, you know. Free speech is, I want to tell you, or free speech is, I don't want you to know. Free speech is also privacy. There's another side to this. The Fourth Amendment is your guaranteed privacy. Most people don't practice that. The Supreme Court says there's no constitutional guarantee to privacy. Huh? The Fourth Amendment doesn't guarantee my right to privacy? Come on, wait a minute. It's true that the Constitution does not use the word private or privacy and say you got this right to privacy, but hey, wait a minute. If I've got a right to be protected in my person, my houses, my papers, and my effects, excuse me, could you tell me what's more private than my person, houses, papers, and effects? And if I'm protected by law, well, then isn't that a protection of my privacy? I listen to this crap all the time, and I kind of wonder, are these people asleep? Are they walking around in a trance or something? Can they think at all? Can we look at a definition of a word in the dictionary and then come to an understanding? Boys and girls, the Fourth Amendment is a guarantee of your privacy. You got a right to free speech. You got a right to blab all. It's like, kind of like a woman, you know. You know, there's a telegraph, a telephone, and a telewoman. I don't know that that's exactly true, but, you know, that's the way the adage goes. I mean, you can blab everything you want to, but then if you don't want to, do I have to tell? One of the things I noticed here was a case called Heibel. One of my students out in Montana is arguing this thing of free speech as it relates to identification. A policeman came up to him and said, hey, what's your name? He said, I ain't telling. Cop said, well, you're obstructing and delaying, and so I'm going to prosecute you here. And so he's arguing that case. Well, that's been argued before. I mean, it's not something new, but there's a new wrinkle came in Nevada here a couple of years ago. It's called Heibel. You got a new rule on Heibel, on identification, you know. And then there's some more tests coming down. And of course, that's what courts and judges are all about. You know, well, let's see if we can understand this. Let's get some more information in here. Does Heibel overturn Brown v. Texas and Lawson versus Colander? I don't think it does. So then what we need is a little better understanding. Well, there's a case here called Charles Wolfe that gives us a better understanding of privacy and this thing of freedom of speech. Listen to this. Businesses that are said to be clothed with a public interest, justifying some public regulation, may be divided into three classes. Those which are carried on under authority of a public grant of privileges, expressly or impliedly imposing the affirmative duty of rendering public service demanded by any member of the public, such as the business of a common carrier or a public utility. Hey, nothing private about a common carrier like Yellow Freight or Yellow Cab. And they're regulated and controlled. All right. B. Certain occupations regarded as exceptional, the public interest attaching to which, recognized from earliest times, has survived the period of arbitrary regulation of all trades and callings by Parliament or colonial legislatures, such as inns, cabs, and gristmills. Hey, you go down here to Denny's, you go in here to the Holiday Inn. Holiday Inn and Denny's, those are regulated enterprises and businesses. The businessman submits to this regulation for the benefits that he receives therefrom. Remember that? All right. Here's number three, though. Other businesses, such as Gordon's Law School, other businesses which have come to have such a peculiar relation to the public that government regulation has been superimposed upon them, where the owner, by devoting his business to the public use, in effect grants the public an interest in that use, and then subjects himself to regulation to the extent of such an interest. So that's why here at the law school we use this term. We say the law school is open to individuals by prearrangement, by contract. This is a private law school. You can't come here. That's right. This is a private law school. You cannot attend this law school. It's not open to the public. A lot of times people gasp and they say, I've never heard of such a thing. Well, now you have. I do not want my school to be subject to regulation. I don't want to be open to the public. So I can't advertise in the Yellow Pages. I can't put a billboard up on the highway. I can't, in short, act in trade, commerce, business, and industry that affects any public interest. And that's what we're doing here. We're avoiding that public interest. And then we want to keep it private. We want to keep it personal. Years ago, a guy by the name of Daniel Shore, who worked, for, I think it was for CBS, back during the Watergate scandal, Daniel Shore had an inside piece of information. And so he was subpoenaed into court, and the judge said, tell us this information. And Daniel Shore said, no, no, not by the hair on my chinny chin chin. This is protected speech. This is protected by the First Amendment. It's protected because I'm a member of the press. And the judge said, to hell you beller, and threw him in jail for contempt. So CBS and all the do-gooders you know around said, well, that judge over there, why, he can't do that. Why, he's interfering here with freedom of the press. And so this case wound its way through and pretty soon got up to the Supreme Court. And they said, you don't have any freedom of the press. Sit down and shut up. Fold your hands. And everybody gasped and they said, oh, my God, the Supreme Court, they've taken away our freedom of press. CBS, NBC, and ABC never have any freedom of the press. They're all commercial enterprises. What do you mean, freedom of the press? They're incorporated under Hale versus Hinkle. An incorporated entity, boys and girls, is for the express purpose of serving the public. And the public interest, the judge said, is in divulging this information for prosecution. The only one that knew which end was up in that case was the judge. He said, hey, what are you talking about, freedom of press here? Now, I want freedom of press. I want freedom of speech. So I can't open my doors to the public. And I'm limited by these public enterprises. But I'm not limited by the private enterprises. I can practice the Ten Commandment model. I just can't practice the Ten Plank model, which is my point. Why would we want to practice the Ten Plank model? Wouldn't we be better off if we were to reestablish our Ten Commandment model and go back to using gold and silver coin, freedom of speech, freedom of the press, freedom of expression, freedom to own property? I mean, wouldn't we be better off if we could own our automobiles to the exclusion of everybody else? I know it's a wild new concept, totally outside the scope of your experience or your imagination. But let's think about it, and maybe, just maybe, there might be one or two of you out there that may say, wow, what a wild new concept. Freedom to own and use your own property, your own way. All right, with that, then, I'm out of time again, and I'm going to have to remind you that you have been listening to the Law Hour, an editorial review sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. The Law Hour is heard 7 days a week here in the United States, and we're heard around the world in more than 120 countries daily over the Internet and radio. If you'd like more information about the law school and the Law Hour, please go to our website at georgegordon.org, georgegordon.org. The law school is a private, non-commercial, non-profit, non-sectarian law school that is open to individuals but by prearrangement. The law school conducts a homeschooling program for adults on compact desk, and the law school and the Law Hour website is updated weekly and has a radio log schedule and archives. All of these Law Hour programs are archived on the Internet by title and date for your listening convenience, and the Law Hour is an educational service brought to you in the public interest. All right, time's up. We got to leave it right there. So we'll see you back here tomorrow night. Same time, same station. God willing, of course. So until then, thanks for listening, everybody, and good night, friends.